Hello, welcome to Greenlit with me, the voice which belongs to Toby Earle. In each episode of Greenlit, a guest receives the thrilling news their life is to be made into a biopic, and we discuss how that story will be told. Will they star? Which moments won't make it into the adaptation? And will King Kong make an appearance? In this episode, actor and comedian Emma Siddy will plot the course of this certain blockbuster. Siddy has starred in Please Like, Prince Andrew the Musical, Alan Partridge Live, Stratagem, and she'll be returning as Kate in the third series of the critically acclaimed rom-com Starstruck. And in her spare time, Siddy also makes clogs for small mice to wear when they travel to Amsterdam. Emma Siddy, welcome to Greenlit.
Thank you for having me. What an amazing introduction, and just so accurate.
If nothing else, this podcast strives for accuracy.
Oh, it's just stunning.
It's just, there's been so much, you know, so much great work of yours we could talk about. But I mean, I mentioned there Prince Andrew the Musical. Emily Maitlis there. Did she ever get in touch and say, I was delighted with your portrayal of me?
No, she didn't. And I think that's fair enough, because I'm not, from Prince Andrew the Musical, you can see that I can sort of sing, but I'm not a professional singer. So I like to think that she was just a bit offended by that. She was like, trust me, girl, I can sing a lot better than that. So no, I didn't hear from her, but that's fine by me. And just getting to do her facial expressions was a dream come true. I loved it.
What was the great line that you sung as you burst through the doors? Mateless fucking nailed it. Was that?
It's something like that. Yeah. It's something like Mateless is a pro and I've gone and fucking nailed it. And I just, it's so easy to deliver lines like that, because I love Emily Maitland. You always watch her and feel like she's nailing it.
I very much want you two to have a night out with karaoke, or, you know, and for there to be footage of it as well.
Yeah.
Because I feel like I need to, like you say, you think she's a good karaoke performer, and you must want to know.
Of course I do. But life is long, and I've got a feeling like that something like that could easily happen. Right place, right time. Me and Emily go nuts.
There's another version of the story coming out, isn't there? It's called Scoop, which is going to be on Netflix. What they should do is they should gather all the Matelesses.
Totally.
And see which one is the best vocalist.
Yeah. Yeah. And that'll be her favourite portrayal of herself. Yeah, I did hear about Scoop. I didn't get the call for Scoop to reprise my role as Mateless. But that's okay as well. I was offering a different thing maybe to what Scoop is looking for.
Well, Emma, thank you for coming on to Greenlit. We will be here working out how the story of your life is told.
Yeah,
and you've been in many, many pieces of television, and you've been in many pieces of art. I mean, how do these kind of meetings take place normally? Are you used to these kind of meetings with executives when you sit down to discuss projects?
God, that's a good question. So I do write as well, but I'm a writer in residence at a production company. I do writer's rooms, but I've never been in the situation of going, hi, we're the Disney execs, you know, we've got $100 million for you, babe. Here's your movie. So that is a treat to be in that kind of conversation today with you, Toby.
I would like to know more about these writers' rooms. Can you say which writers' rooms and which theatre company you're allowed to? Is that permitted?
So yeah, the company is called Dancing Ledge. So they're a TV production company. They did The Responder, which is so amazing. So I feel
Salisbury Poisonings as well.
Yeah, God, you just know it. Yeah. So it's a total. Well, not to be too much of a lovey about it, but it's a dream come true to be that. But it is, it's great. So working with them kind of in-house, which is really, really nice. And then on top of that, you know what's so weird with writers' rooms, isn't it? Because you sort of don't want to, because they're shows that exist.
Mm.
But sometimes I'm not sure if you can really say. That makes it sound like I'm lying, doesn't it? But
well,
you know what I mean?
It makes me think, sorry to interrupt, Emma, but it makes me think, excuse me, just a man talking over a woman. But listen, it makes me think you deserve credits. Credit where credit's due, right?
Yeah, but a lot of TV shows, the way they're made is that you have the really early development process.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe 1 or 2 weeks or even just a few days. And then the writer Well, this is the UK system. The UK writer will then go off and kind of like make the show and like make it in a very authored way, but kind of jumping off that maybe two, three week starting point. So that's the only reason why I'm a bit like, oh. But I think if you just click around on the internet, you can find out.
When you mentioned the responder, was that something you might have?
I wasn't involved in the responder. No. Okay, no. I was not.
Just Tony
involved.
Schumacher was that? That was just Tony. Was that?
Yeah,
just Tony?
Exactly. I think that was just totally all Tony on his own. It's pretty great.
And what a great piece of television that is. And if your life story is told with the kind of intensity of the responder, my word.
Imagine.
Well, okay, it is your film. This is the story of your life, Emma. Mm. So where would you like to meet the executives who have come to you to tell you they want to make this story? Where would you meet them? Would you meet them in an office or would you meet them in a restaurant? Would you meet them in a studio? Where would you like to meet them?
Right. I would pick a swanky London hotel because I've had like, I don't know, maybe one or two meetings in my life in those. And you always feel like you've made it. Even if the meeting is a total disaster and you leave it going, well, that was horrible, you still feel like you've made it by getting that like £5.50 tea off the exec. It's just fabulous. Love it. So yeah, I'd say something like, I feel like I once had a drink in the London Edition Hotel.
The London Edition.
And if I said, meet me in the London Edition, it might sound like I know what I'm talking about.
Yes. That's like, you know, in always American films, people meet at the Chateau Marmont.
Yeah, exactly.
Meet me in the Edition, the London.
Yeah,
Edition.
So you want something slightly off, super famous. If you say the Ritz, you know, they know it's bullshit. They can call your bluff. If you say the London Edition, they go, God, I've never even heard of that. Turn up, they think you know what you're talking about.
Does meeting in a, you say you've had a couple of meetings in a swanky hotel. Does that make you more nervous? Does it make you feel more on edge?
I think it makes me more intent on ordering as much as I can. So more like thinking in advance, oh, I wonder if they do jasmine tea and maybe a cake, because you know what it's worth. Do you know what I mean? No need to be nervous. Just come hungry and thirsty.
So I was going to say, firstly, do you go there, right? And, you know, if you start ordering too much, does it look like you're taking the piss? Like, it literally looks like you're taking the piss. Or do you look at the menu in advance and when they sit down, you say, oh, I'll have the usual, the jasmine tea and the finger sandwiches, like you do it all the time, and this is nothing to you?
I think it's the latter, to be honest. I think you look at the menu in advance, you know, get a taste for it, get a feel of what you're going to go in there and order. It's the joy of it as well, because then you can really look forward to what's going to be there. And I say all of this knowing that Lady Gaga said at the VMAs like 4 years ago, when you have meetings with big people or something, never, ever eat the food, never eat the sushi, because show them that you're just an artist and you're here to work. I do completely the opposite of that. And it's not that I don't love my job and I'm very, you know, want the best for my career, but I need that sushi. I actually have eaten that sushi and it was so good.
I love the idea of a meeting taking place, say at the breakfast buffet of a Premier Inn or some similar hotel, and you're walking around, not just you, plural, you are walking around spooning on beans and scrambled eggs while these executives are walking behind you with notebooks going, yeah, but anyway, we'd like to talk about that. And look, you should have these hash browns, they're terrific. And just literally loading up that plate with as much as possible.
Well, that's it. We're freelancers, you know. So you need to, when you see a free lunch, you need to get involved, make the most, make a beautiful memory from it.
Well, exciting news. Your life has been greenlit for a biopic.
Oh, fantastic.
How would your life be told by Hollywood or Bollywood or Nollywood? And what sort of creative control would you exercise in bringing the greatest story you know to the big screen? So Emma Siddy, first question, it's a biggie. What's the film called? What is the biopic? What is the biopic of Emma Siddy's life called?
Okay, so I'm not sure I should be allowed a pun, but it would be called Sex and the City, the movie.
Yes! Yes!
Sex and the City 3, I guess. But yeah, Sex and the City, the movie. Two reasons. A, I love the name. B, it would be the only way of getting the American market to understand my surname. The only way. It is so amazing with Americans. With Emma Siddy, I know it's obviously a bit of an unusual surname anyway, but in the UK, people just see it and they see Siddy. In America, they can't see Siddy. Like, it's not, oh, they don't usually, they cannot see it. And they try everything, which is also really understandable. But when I say Siddy, no, it's like Siddy, they can't say it back when they can see the name because they just can't not think of C-I-T-Y. So they can only get my name right if I say, like, New York City. And then they go, New York City. Oh, city, city. Oh, my God. City, New York City, Kansas City. And then they can say my surname. So it would actually be a really cheeky marketing ploy. If it's Sex and the City, the movie, people will actually learn my name, which would be so cool for me.
Okay, got some things here, right? Got some things here. Firstly, I'm a little bit hurt that you would think that I wouldn't allow a pun.
Okay.
I'm a bit hurt by that.
I can accept that.
And because it's a magnificent pun.
Thank you. And
it's a magnificent pun, but it also has purpose. And that's really, and that is even better. It's not just a funny pun, it has purpose. And
yeah.
I also want to know, when you just did an American accent there, and by the way, that was very American.
Oh.
I know you do VO work and you're an actor and you do voices. Mm. You had that person saying New York City, Kansas City. Is that something that's literally happened to you where someone stood and just repeated the names of cities and like, as they're kind of getting their head wrapped around
it? I think
it?
I've done it for them because we're getting into such a crazy situation with it. As in, to be honest, if my movie was called Sex in the City, they would still say Sex in the Sidey. They just can't say it. So yeah, I've been in like, particularly with... what was it? Like, I had to sort of go to a sort of American GP, you know, an emergency seeing a doctor.
Oh.
And no, it was very, very small. Don't you worry about it. Very, very minor burn. Anyway. But in that moment, yeah, we had to run through what it sounds like to say the names of cities to just try and feel how to pronounce it. Anyway. I should just leave it. I do usually leave it. But.
There's a sense there of the emergency situation being overtaken by a pronunciation issue.
Yeah.
You know, like kind of there's that thing of people sort of being distracted from pain, so they forget they're actually in pain.
Right.
Like, it sounds very much like the doctor might have completely unintentionally done this, but like you're there going, no, you have to. The phonetics of the surname are forgetting about this minor burn. Well, I'm glad it was only minor, and it's
was so minor.
I must also ask, are you a fan of Sex and the City?
Of course, love it. Not necessarily the movies, I gotta say. So it'd be a really fun opportunity to kind of give the movies a new spin, as in the name, you know, to use it in a different way. Movies were pretty shocking, I think, as most people are in agreement. But that show is it, in my opinion.
And do you like Just Like That and Just Like That? Have you been watching that? Do you like and Just
Like
That?
Oh, where to begin and Just Like That. I mean, I was really giving it a lot of hope and strength and faith in that first series. But I think already this second series, I don't know, I just don't think I can deal with it anymore. It just feels like it's written by ChatGPT. It feels like the first AI show. Anyway, sorry, that's so harsh. There are bits that are great.
Would you turn a part down?
No, I wouldn't. I'd love to be involved.
Emma City in and Just Like That and the City. Okay, it's a great title. Sex and the City, the movie, is such a great title. So what's the opening scene? How does Sex and the City, the movie, begin?
It's hard, this. I think if I had to pick, you want to start anything with a kind of sequence or a, you know, a big comedy opening where, you know, you're excited.
Yep.
So that's obviously quite hard to think about that in your own life. But I'd put it in. So I studied Spanish at uni and I went to Mexico on my year abroad. And for some reason, my job when I was abroad was to teach drama improv lessons, like improvisation lessons, to Mexican teenagers.
Okay.
But because I did Spanish from scratch at university, my Spanish was shit, like so bad. Basically couldn't speak it at all, could just do the accent and some nouns. By the end, you know, I came out, I was able to totally speak it. But at the beginning, it was so insanely bad. And so, maybe the opening scene would be me running, age 20, me teaching my first ever improv lesson at a leisure center in Mexico, 2011. Because it was just, no, 2012. It was just so stupid and such a disaster, but so fun. And I think maybe you also want the beginning of a film to kind of set the opening theme. And so I think that's quite a good moments of hubris mixed with lack of communication is maybe a nice theme for this movie.
Moments of hubris. Hang on. Moments of hubris. What was that? Accompanied by miscommunication.
Miscommunication. Yeah. As well as, yeah, I just, what I really remember is, you know, because quite a classic improv scenario is being in a doctor's office, a doctor's waiting room or waiting room for a dentist, something like that. And I've got these teenagers, like 25 kids have turned up because, you know, there's an improv class in Tuxtla Gutierrez, Mexico. They're like, this is so cool. They've turned up really like a lot of goodwill in the room. And I'm there. And I think what they would have heard, the equivalent of what they would have heard would be something like, so you are in a room for dentist. And they're just like, right. And what do we do with that? I really couldn't speak this language. And I just had to let them improvise. And when they were improvising their scenes, I wouldn't understand what the hell was going on. And I'd just say like freeze in Spanish, or probably even at that stage in English, and be like, ah, so as you can see there, this we learned a lot. Yeah, mad.
How did you end up teaching, not Spanish to Spanish speakers, but like how did you end up teaching Spanish teenagers improv yeah. when you couldn't speak Spanish?
Look, you can do anything if you want to do it that enough, you know? If you want to do something, you can do it. So with my year abroad, it was second year of uni, and they said, right, it's your year abroad next year. My uni was particularly like, you can kind of do what you want. So I went to Paris for 4 months to study. And then I was like, then I'm going to work in the Mexico bit. So I sort of applied to like, they're called cultural centers, that like Centro Cultural, they're called cultural centers, but right. really they're sort of like leisure centers. They're actually amazing things that exist in Latin America and don't exist here. Leisure centers that focus on the arts. So I spoke to one of those and they were like, yeah, sure. Like, come on down. And that was it.
It feels worryingly easy that you could just slide into someone's educational experience.
Crazy. Like that. Absolutely crazy. I was also teaching English to little kids through drama. That was a bit more, you know, sensible, I think.
Yeah.
But I got to say, teaching teenagers improvisation, it does make your Spanish get really good, really quick.
Well, I did wonder how fast did it develop compared to, I mean, how fast it developed and how much faster do you think it developed compared to maybe not being in that situation if you weren't?
Oh my God. It was not to be too much of a sort of geek or show off. It was unbelievable. So in January, I went and really terrible, terrible Spanish, like holiday Spanish. By probably 2 months later, I was able to sort of make jokes, hold my own, whatever. Then I left in August. So it'd been 8 months and I was completely fluent. And I still sort of am. It's really weird.
8 months?
Just stuck. Yeah, 8 months. And wow. Yeah, I can speak Spanish, boy. So if you want to learn a language, you go and teach improv to the country's teenagers and see how you do.
That is, I mean, and also, what surely if you're doing improv, what an incredible array of esoteric words and phrases you must have picked up, because improv obviously Absolutely. Flies off in directions which you don't predict, can't predict.
Yeah, and teenagers, their favourite kind of scenarios are either stuff like set in space or gossip, you know, and being like, yo, girl, like, because you've done that to me, I'm going to do this to you because you're a bitch. And that is great language learning, you know, that's fast-paced. It's a lot of different conjugations. It's past tense. It's future tense. It's you said this, so I'm going to say this to you. You know, it's useful grammar.
I'm really sorry, but what does that sound like in Spanish if you do gossipy teen bitches? What does that sound like in Spanish?
Teen bitches will be something like, bueno, desde mi punto de vista, ustedes son zorras. Pues lo que pasa es que no voy a hablar ninguna más con ustedes. It's like that. It's like, blah, 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 blah. It's gorgeous.
I feel as I often do around people, intimidated. There's a sense of intimidation.
Well, no, I think I used a word wrong there actually. So hopefully a Spanish speaker is listening and going, "Oh, she's not that fluent."
And what else could you have done, like in that cultural center? Was there anything else? Like, could you have literally said anything, or were there other things you could have taught?
Well, those were my classes. I taught a sort of schedule of those classes. Weirdly, the classes would be the same groups 3 times a week. Like, they were quite intensive for both me and for them. But in my free time, I would attend classes. So I went to salsa classes 3 times a week.
Are you good?
I was good at the time. I really haven't done it since, because you just, you know, it's so part of the lifestyle there. Where I was, it was so part of the lifestyle. Whereas here, it feels a bit weird being like, want to dance, you know?
It's not the same thing. I've just got to go to the co-op to get some milk and I'm off to salsa class.
Yeah.
It doesn't feel quite right. Where were you in Mexico? Were you in a city or a town? Were you rural?
I was in a city in the south called Tuxtla Gutierrez. And I grew up in Woking. And it was a lot like the Woking of Mexico. Pretty nondescript. Wouldn't necessarily recommend it, but lovely people. And there was a Las Iguanas. No, there wasn't a Las Iguanas. But, you know, it's hard to explain. It was like 35 degrees, tropical heat, but was kind of like Woking.
That's the same kind of almost, what is it, sort of dislocating, like even more dislocating than if you've been in a big city. Like being in somewhere that's kind of suburban must feel even stranger.
Oh, it's amazing because you make friends. It's so easy to make friends places like that because people are so interested in someone from far away. It's not like a metropolitan city where they're like, yeah, we see different people all the time.
Yeah.
You know, people were like, you're English. What the fuck are you doing here? You're going to be my friend. So that was great. Mixed with, I think that's the most amazing thing about getting to live somewhere for a while, that, you know, when you're younger as well, and there's kind of, you don't have a job yet, you don't really have an identity yet, you can go somewhere like Tuxtla Gutierrez and just be like, right, well, I'm here for 8 months, let's see what's up.
Would you go back and teach in Mexico? Career change, would you do it?
Yeah, as a huge career change, I would do it. Yeah, because I, as a country, I miss it like mad. I talk about it way too much. I just loved it. Tuxtla wasn't, I mean, the heat was insane. You know, I kind of was never not sweating.
Would Prince Andrew sweat there?
Prince Andrew would even Prince Andrew might sweat there. It was that hot.
That hot. It's a strong comedy opening, particularly, you know, the raft of blank faces when you start trying to speak and there's just absolutely no response because you're not connecting, you're not communicating, you're not doing the thing you're meant to be doing. That's never not funny.
And we can have a lot of fun with subtitles, you know, which I always really enjoy.
Well, anyway. I think it's worth noting, of course, because you made your own web series, right? Pilot.
Yeah, exactly. Kind of TV pilot. Yeah. La Princesa de Woking. Sorry,
yeah.
Woking's come up again.
Look, I'm sure Paul Weller talks about it all the time as well. But for anyone who doesn't know, La Princesa de Woking, it was a spoof telenovela set in Woking. So it had all, I watched it and I'd like, it has all the trappings of a telenovela, right? That's right. Yeah. And it's sort of, and you're this heightened individual, but it's in Woking.
Yeah. Well, the concept was, because you, with these telenovelas, you do feel that they kind of pick, they just think of a topic or a setting and go with it. Like one is completely set in a, the prison of a mine, like a coal mine, but the prison bit. Very niche to me. So the idea was that these Mexican producers have gone, let's set it somewhere quite fabulous, quite unknown to us, to really explore the British experience. Woking looks cool. So they found it on the map and then just imagined the experience. So that's the kind of bizarre premise. So at the beginning, there's a logo. It goes, Prismo de Mexico presenta. You know, Mexican Prism Productions present. So even that's fake. You know, it was really fun kind of thinking of the little trappings of this show and the production company that's made it.
Did anyone, because it's on YouTube, it is on YouTube, isn't it? I'm pretty sure.
It is. We actually, you know what? That's reminded me. It got delisted because it was on BBC for a bit. And I think that's run out. So I got to relist it. Maybe I'll relist it today.
Well, so, I'm glad to have played a small part in relisting La Princesa de Woking. Did anyone in the comments get in touch and say, oh, this is like, who thought it was a real thing? Who thought it was a real show?
No, I think it's too ridiculous. But yeah, I think the link's in my Instagram bio if I forget to relist it, but I will try and relist it today.
It's good to have something to look forward. It's good to have a little job, just a little job, a little fun job.
Exactly. Little to-do thing. Yeah.
Yeah. So we've got the opening scene. Strong opening scene, confident, cocky 20-year-old, basically being stared down by a bunch of teenage Mexicans with dreams of improvisational comedy careers. But who's cast in the lead, Emma Siddy? Who is cast as Emma Siddy?
Well, what a crazy question, eh? But I would say, I just think Emma Mackey's amazing.
Oh.
I think she's so great. And then also, she speaks French, or I think actually is French. So she could have a bit of, I don't know, I think she'd be amazing with language stuff. And then also Patsy Ferran, she's an actor. You know Patsy Ferran? She has been very kind of lauded in theatre, and she's amazing. So I think one of those two. But maybe I'd say Emma Mackey, because I saw her recently in that film, Emily. She's just fantastic, I reckon. And you always want to cast a taller, more Margot Robbie looking version of yourself. So yeah, let's go with Emma Mackey.
I mean, Patsy Farron, I will admit, is a name I've not encountered prior to this conversation.
Stuff. She's brilliant.
And Emma Mackey, yeah, she is terrific. And she's in the Barbie movie as well. Yeah,
famously.
Yes. Being, you know, it's nice to see her do comedy.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously she does funny stuff in Sex Education, but you know, this is an outright comedy. But the language thing's interesting because you how many languages do you speak?
Oh, well, no, I speak French and Spanish, and then I speak conversational German and Italian and terrible Turkish. I do speak a bit of Turkish, but it's really bad. You know, Turkish is literally just we're in a restaurant sort of thing.
I love the alliteration of terrible Turkish. Sounds like a horrible histories chapter about the Ottoman Empire. But like, how come so many languages? Like, is that something within your family? Is this something within, you know, is this part of your family
it's
background?
It's personal interest, but I think it is. I think it is caused by something. My family lived in Germany for a few years between the ages of 4 and 6. And I went to, you know, German kindergarten and spoke fluent baby German.
You went to an actual kindergarten. I mean, we all go to kindergarten, but you went to an actual
I went to a kindergarten. Yeah. So, and then I came back to England and, you know, and there's none of those languages in my family, but well, basically I've realized this from other people who are into languages. They almost always had some real exposure thing as a baby. Even if you don't really remember that language after, I think it just makes you better at it at school.
Right,
so kind of without even meaning to be the case, my best subjects at school were languages. And then as you get older, it becomes a real interest and a passion. But for me, it was mainly like, oh, these are my safest GCSEs sort of thing. Because I'm crap at maths.
Nothing wrong with going for the safest GCSEs, by the way. But it is interesting you say you think it's just because you were exposed to it from a young age that it was just that lodged somewhere.
I think so. Mm. My best friend at uni doing French and Russian, she was in Holland for the exact same time as a baby. It just, there's quite a few, those things often occur, basically. That's my theory.
You mentioned this before, but like with that, you know, would you have multiple languages in Sex and the City? Would you have people, you know, would you have Emma Mackey as you speaking in French, speaking in Spanish? Would there be lots of subtitles going on?
It would be great for casting, wouldn't it? Because then you can really enjoy all the other people in the different countries. You know, you can ask Penelope Cruz if she'll do a walk-on part.
Yes.
You can beg, I'm trying to think of another French actor now. You can beg Juliette Binoche to do a little part.
Yes.
But, you know, I don't know, but I think I love traveling. I love speaking languages, which is a weird thing to say, but you know, it's genuinely really enjoyable. So yeah, why not throw that in?
As a multilingual speaker, does this mean when you're watching French or Spanish pieces of television and film, you don't have to look at the subtitles, or do you anyway?
I do anyway, but I realize I do that with English as well. It's a weird thing about subtitles, isn't there? Like, you just sort of get addicted to them when they're on screen. Do you know what I mean? It's bizarre with English subtitles, even. Your eyes are resting on them. So I do end up doing it anyway, to be totally honest.
I have found myself watching more programs with subtitles on, like English speaking programs, sometimes because of the naturalistic dialogue or the way it's recorded. And I don't want to pump up the speakers to 1,000 decibels because I can't quite hear. But what does this annoy you? As a speaker of many languages, it annoys me when the subtitles don't exactly match what is said on screen. Like if a word or two is out, and I think, well, that's annoying because that's not actually what that person is saying. It's wrong.
Yeah, you feel like the caption writer has just gone, oh, you know what, fuck it, they're never going to notice. We have noticed, actually. Yeah, I completely agree with you. It's very frustrating.
So let's get a really fastidious caption writer for Emma City's film. Okay, we've got a cast. We've got the lead. Let me see. But what genre would the film be, and why? And what sort of budget are we looking at, Emma City?
Oh, God. I don't know about the budget. Budget, give me 10 mil just in case. and I'll give it back if we don't use it all. I would say a comedy. I feel like I'm a bit of a comedy of errors person. So that would be fun. Like I said, the miscommunication element to it.
Yeah,
I think comedy's what I'm into anyway. I think the second you made this a drama or an action movie, it would just... I don't know. It just doesn't sit right. It has to be a comedy, I think.
What, and where does, I mean, is that something when you were younger, was comedy, where you were drawn to comedy? Has that always been a constant, do you think?
Yeah, it has. I really don't know why. Really has always been like that. Really obsessed with Reeves and Mortimer as a kid. Like just rewatching those VHS tapes. Yeah, just crazy about it. So,
what in particular? Which Smell of, Bang Bang?
Smell of. I mean, I was obsessed with Shooting Stars as well, but Smell of, Reason Mortimer was the stuff that I would just watch on repeat, like it was Fireman Sam, just really into it. And even when I watch it, I was watching it because they're doing reruns, I think, on BBC Two.
They have been, yeah.
Yeah, which is so cool. And just, I just feel this connection to that stuff. I just really loved it as a six-year-old. And then at school, I don't know, this is really embarrassing and naff, but, you know, writing sketch. I sent in a packet of sketches to the BBC when I was 8 or 9.
Oh, my God.
And because you used to be able to do that, basically. And they said they'd always provide feedback. And they did. And 3 months later, they sent absolutely brutal feedback. Like, fucking harsh.
Did they know you were 8 or 9 years old?
I guess they didn't. I mean, that's the one compliment I can take from it, looking back. Because, you know, my mum said, well, look, if you've written all these sketches and you want to send them in, just do that then. So we, you know, she helped me put it in this A4 envelope and this cover letter and whatever. And I think I sent in 5 sketches and, like, printed out on our, like, tiny world computer. And, yeah, so then they wrote back and she said, oh, look, you've got your thing from the BBC. It literally took 3 months, which at that, you know, at that age, 3 months is, like, 5 years.
Yeah.
So you open it up and you go, oh my God, I'm going to be the first child comic genius. And yeah, got out the feedback. Dear Miss City, thank you so much for sending these in. They are nowhere near good enough. This is not the standard we're looking for at the BBC. Even the fact you said that these could be for radio is completely inappropriate, as it's mostly visual gags. Strongly recommend you take steps to, yeah, I'm reading this, probably reading out loud. And my mom's like, oh my God. And, you know, she like taps me on the back, like, oh, well, there you go, you see, you know, just got stuff to work on. And, oh, but yeah, honestly, that best possible thing that could have happened, because I think any kid that is into comedy is inherently precocious. So you need to, like, show them what's what. You need to tell them their shit. So I think that was a real blessing. And well done, my mum, for, I don't remember her ever going, oh, well, that's awful of them. You know, she was like, well, you better listen to that, kid.
Yeah. Given now that you're, you know, a successful writer and actor and comic, have you ever been asked by the BBC to take a look at some scripts someone sent in? And have you been equally as ruthless?
Oh, my God. No, I haven't. I haven't, because I've never been in-house. I haven't ever thought of that, actually. Because I have had to do some script judge, or, you know, script reading, script judging for, like, competitions. Shit, yeah. But maybe the stuff I've read has been very good. I think it's important to realise that this stuff I sent in was bad. Like,
was it?
It must have been.
Have you not seen it? Have you not? I mean, do you not remember
anything? I think I blocked it out. I was so embarrassed. I think one was about a woman in a bath, and this man comes in and she's like, get out of the bathroom. So no, and I think it was all very, yeah, it was dated even in 1999 or whatever it was. So yeah, not good stuff, not good.
How did your love of comedy expand beyond Reeves and Mortimer? Did it expand? Did you, what was that the kind of gateway to? Were there other things which then kind of you fell for, which then started forming the way you thought about comedy and what you wanted to do or write?
Yeah, I was always crazy about kind of Victoria Pyle stuff when I was a teenager. So Green Wing, Smack the Pony, those kind of shows, just like consuming those. And really at that time when it's, you know, they're out once a week and my parents just about letting me watch them. So into those, obviously French and Saunders and all, but even that I was probably watching after the time of it. But yeah, box sets and just going crazy for British comedy, kind of the whole of, yeah, teenage.
Green Wing, I don't think we've mentioned before, like that is such an incredible show.
There might only be two series.
The first series of that, it was two series, yeah. And the first series though is, I mean, unbelievably good. The cast list is insane as well. Like the quality of the cast is crazy.
And I think the way it really, it did something that is, it was so unique to itself that it can't even be done again because it's just copying Green Wing. Like it is with Peep Show. Like the whole, the fast forwards of the transitions and stuff. It just has so its own style and flavour mixed with being actually funny and really naughty, whatever, you know, pretty gross. So, loved it. I've met Victoria Pyle and that was hard because, you know, I was just like, hello, lovely to meet you. So, and she's amazing, but really starstruck by meeting her. She actually met me in a kind of giving me advice kind of way. It was really amazing. She was an amazing person and so warm and generous with her time and her experience. So, yeah, that was cool. That's very cool.
So I'm assuming that would be a part of your life that would have to be in the film, because that's the next question, Emma. Mm-hmm. What parts of your life would definitely have to be in Sex and the City and why?
Well, I don't think, I actually wouldn't put stuff like that in there. It's a bit workplacey. It's a bit like, all right, you know. I think as a viewer, you want to see your character fail, basically. You want to see the failures and you want to see the conflict, I reckon. So after this sort of improv stuff in Mexico, I think it would be fun to see the early 20s flailingness of trying to get into comedy professionally. So what I actually did was I worked as a substitute French and Spanish teacher in primary schools.
Right.
And so either that would be longer stints. I had a very weird stint at an all-boys prep school. Ugh. So that was, I was a like French mamselle there, really odd.
Then
other ones would
go on.
I can't. It's just, I don't think, I'm not so keen on all boys schools, I don't think. I think it makes them mad. Because these kids were only 11, but they were crazy.
Can you name the school? Name the school.
No, I can't. I can't possibly, because I want to go back there.
were they like entranced by the presence of a woman? Were they basically a young woman there and they were
so
just...
I was 22 and I think I looked younger.
Right.
So it didn't help. You know, I was like an older sister in old people. You know, I was wearing school teacher clothes to try and give off the vibe that you should respect me.
Yeah.
But really, they just took the piss. you know, I got the job in a crazy way. I completely blagged it. Other than, yes, I had a degree in French. But otherwise, you know, and when I was bollocking them as well, when I was like telling them off, that was such seat of your pants stuff. I did not know what I was doing at all. I had to do a parents' evening. That was embarrassing.
Oh my gosh.
Imagine these like, and also this was an expensive school. You know, these guys would have been like, sorry, we're paying this much for that girl. That fucking girl. So yeah, and the stakes were very high, I think, because people are paying for it. But then what I really, really enjoyed, I was a substitute Spanish teacher for literally infant schools, but like, you know, state infant schools around London. And that was actually amazing, but also came with big risks because I was a substitute teacher. There were no stakes of coming back the next day. So I used to play this like a really great way of teaching kids the colors in Spanish. For me, was to pretend to be this kind of troll, and they have to take the different colored pencils off my hands. But so many times I made kids cry because I think my troll was like just really convincing. And I'd sort of just leave these crying, screaming kids and just like get on the tube and go. So yeah, so I'd just chuck in a lot of that sort of stuff. Because it was mixed alongside doing gigs in the evening, like running from that to gigs. Or at one point, once sacking it off entirely because I got a part in something. So that kind of the balancing of those things, I think, could be have a bit of dynamism to it.
What was the energy transfer like in terms of sort of your from going from teaching infant Spanish and maybe leaving them as they're crying and then going to do a gig in the evening? Like how did you manage those transitions, that kind of different energy?
Not to be facetious, they're really similar things. Like even you say that, you're sort of entertaining these kids, trying to teach them a lesson, getting a huge reaction. Then you're going to, you know, the invisible dot at the time, like a little stage in King's Cross, and doing the exact same thing, giving them a good time, maybe trying to teach them something. Some of them are not going to like it, running off again. Like actually totally the same thing, blagging both.
Were you doing stand-up or were you doing character comedy?
Comedy, yeah. So my character comedy is always sort of almost as stand-up, but yeah, very much character comedy. So yeah, same thing, playing a teacher, playing a troll, playing a comedian, playing, I don't know, whatever I used to do.
Who were those early characters? What kind of characters do you have in stage on those early days?
Oh, God. I can't remember. I think I'm really bad at... anything I feel unsure about, I just block it out. You know, when you're just like, I have all these huge blanks. I had a character who had no neck, and that was my big thing. It just didn't exist. Yeah, she was her two traits were annoying and had no neck, and she was from California, I think. Another one was like Mancunian and obsessed with her siblings. That I really liked. I find people obsessed with their siblings very funny. Because there's loads of them. You know, people who are just like, oh, my brother is just so amazing. And I'm just spending tonight with my brother.
Do you have siblings?
I do. I've got two brothers. And I also probably are sometimes like, oh, love my brothers. It's terrible.
But and the characters based on people that you knew that who always talked about their siblings more than themselves, or always sort of like big them up maybe?
People have overly close relationships with their siblings.
Is that creepy?
Yeah, I find it creepy and really funny. It's such a specific, weird thing, you know? I once had a friend go, my brother's going to have to break up with his girlfriend because she just can't make him orgasm.
What? 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 Wow.
That's your brother. No, you're not allowed to know or think that.
Oh, boy.
It's so matter of fact. So yeah, so various crazy things that I, yeah, loved doing and whatever. But, and also, you know, funding Edinburgh via this work as well. It was like, yeah.
Was that the kind of thing you would do as you were working? Were you always thinking about next year's Edinburgh? Was that always the end goal or?
Yeah, it was, yeah. And I remember there was one of the other French teachers said to me once, she said, oh, it's just so unlikely you're going to be able to do this as a career realistically, isn't it? And I did agree with her. I was like, yeah, I know. She was like, so what's great is that you can always come back here and just be a French teacher forever. And I kind of had thought of that. But when she said it to me in the moment, I was like, right. That was in the all boys prep school. I was like, I got to make this Edinburgh work, man. Yeah, and there's no, I really do love teaching and I would go back to it. I think it was just, it was really good to kind of experience your plan B in real time.
Yeah.
And realize you're going to try for the plan A.
I mean, as a character comedian, I'm, you know, teaching must have not just been the classroom, but like you said, the parents' evening, that must give you an awful lot of sort of, not necessarily material, but sort of, yeah. Situations of mentally which to draw when you're improvising or you're thinking of how a character would react to sort of
yeah
I think
that's definitely true in that if you know if anyone was to ask me who was about to graduate from uni or just going straight into it of what to do I do think the best thing is to get just get a normal job or just live before freaking out about this as a career just try and work because oh God, it makes such a difference. Then, yeah, obviously I had to anyway, but it is the stuff to do. It's great.
It is, I mean, you're not the only one, like Greg Davies and Ramesh Ranganathan,
they were both
teachers as well.
Yeah, maybe it's the performance element as well. And the whole, you know, faking it till you make it when you're in front of that whiteboard.
Oh, I've got a question. Sorry, and we will move on. I just have to know, as someone who has been a teacher, did you ever experience the weird situation when someone from a pupil from your school sees you outside of school in a location they wouldn't expect, like a supermarket or a pub or, you know, a betting shop?
You know what? Two things. I was a substitute teacher. So right. Thank God, always in different boroughs. So that was unlikely. And also primary school age. So right. If they'd more have to come into the betting shop.
Yes.
And they would be banned from getting in the first place.
Yes.
So that was my real safe place. I'm joking. But but yeah, no, I think I was very lucky in that respect. What did happen, they found me on Instagram, which felt like such, you know, it was awful, awful.
Oh, God.
I think my profile picture was me cuddling my cat or something. I just remember being like, this is dangerous. This is not good.
I don't mean to ask another question about this, and I promise we'll move on, but it just occurred to me that when you're talking about sort of people like following you on Instagram, the staff at the all boys school, you mentioned about being a substitute teacher, like how did the staff respond to you at an all boys school, a fee paying all boys school? Were there, did you experience the same sort of disrespect from the staff or?
I think the state schools I went to in London felt more together and like they took it more seriously than the private school.
Right.
Basically, even their staff room was like all brown leather chairs. It almost looked like you could smoke in there. It's hard to explain. They're just so, it's so old school that I got the feeling the staff couldn't even really see me at the private school. They were just sort of like, there's a young woman in the corner there. She's the mamselle. You know, there was no acknowledgement of me. Whereas in the state schools, it was much more like, hi, do you have a lesson plan? Because it's a bit more looked at. And this is just the specific school I'm talking about. You know, I don't want to make vast generalizations. But yeah, it was very much like just this random chick who'd turn up, sit in the corner shivering, leave again.
As I said at the top of the podcast, Emma, this podcast it cares about nothing else than accuracy. So
yeah, great.
Massive generalizations aren't allowed here. That is not a massive generalization. That is a specific comment. So I think the accuracy stands. Perfect. I also, however, in this situation, I wouldn't be surprised if the generalization did stand. So I think you're fine. Which moments, though, would you want on the cutting room floor? What isn't going into Sex and the City?
I put temping on the cutting room floor. It was just so boring. There's some bits that were funny, but it's not going to, I don't know. Temping, just get rid. Temping a lot for like a financial services agency. It's just awful. But again, it's good to do it. And actually, it was an amazing chance to write scripts, like start, you know, writing my first scripts, and because you're just on these reception desks for so long. So it was a useful time in my life, but don't put it in a movie because it's too boring. and screw it. Like,
what,
just can't.
What was the most? What was the dullest sort of chore or job that you had to have while you were temping? Was there
this
a particular...
isn't actually that dull, but I did reception for Red Bull for a while, Red Bull HQ, and
right.
Your main job there is to pick up the phone to like giggling high teenagers, asking if there's bull sperm in Red Bull.
What?
And they even said that to you when you get to the desk. They're like, so you will get a lot of these calls. Each time, if you could just note down the number so we can avoid it next time and just politely let them know that there isn't actually bull sperm in the Red Bull. Okay, amazing. Have a great day. And you're like, what are you talking about? Then once you do the job, that is exactly what your day entails. Like 20 calls a day.
20?
And it would always be the same. Like, so like, is there bull sperm in the Red Bull? You have to go, hello. And like basically read from the script. Crazy. So yeah, that was stupid. It's probably in the summer holidays there are extra calls, you know. I was probably doing it at a kind of out of term time. As in, I'm just for the that sheer amount of calls would make sense. Maybe normally it's 5 calls a day, but anyway.
I mean, can you remember what happened the first time you got that call? And then at what point did you become bored of having those? Like, what point did
I think
you...
the second one is boring. The first one is funny. The second one is a bit like, oh, right. So this really is a big part of the job. So that was that. And then my other cutting room floor thing, which I'm sure most people say would be lockdown. I just can't be bothered with that. I'm so annoyed it happened. It was me, Rose Matafeo and Al Roberts living in a 2-bedroom flat together. And it was just too intense. Like, we loved each other and it was great. But also, no interest in revisiting that period. Too claustrophobic. Stupid.
What? Okay.
Oh, you want to see it on film.
Well, it's funny because you and Rose and Al are all very good friends. You and Al are particularly very good friends, having recently married.
Yeah, we
congratulations.
Got married. Thank you so much.
Of course, you both play partners as well in Starstruck.
Yes.
Which... did Rose write that? Write that?
Rose
for that to
wrote that, yeah.
on purpose, like for that to happen.
I suppose. I don't know if it was on purpose. It was obviously on purpose. Oh, yeah. It's just brilliant. I never like to ask too many questions because you're just delighted to be there. But yeah, very funny.
At what point did it become too much lockdown with you and Rose and Al? Did you have an early high where it was novel, and then was there a moment when it was like, oh no, this is too much?
You know
now?
What? It was always quite tough because we were just about to film Starstruck season 1, and when I mean just about, I mean I think the first day of the lockdown. It was really it was such a kind of, oh no, this was about to be the best thing ever and now it will never happen, because that's how it felt at the time. Of course, that isn't the case. But at the time, it really felt like, oh, and now the world ends. No. So we watched movies in a very depressed state for a while. And then Rose did go back to New Zealand for a little bit. And then she came back, obviously, because New Zealand was a much better place to be in terms of not really having a problem with it. Yeah, then she came back. And then that second winter lockdown, that was pretty dark. That was Rose sort of, I think she wrote the entire first 2 series of Starstruck between the cupboard and her bed, because that was the only place that was comfortable in the flat.
Oh my God.
It was just that stuff like that. It was a bit mad, really. And then I was doing a lot of, because you could still do BBC radio plays and stuff and radio comedy. So I also could only do it in her room because the Wi-Fi connection. So I'd have to turf her out, do it in that same corner. It's fine. We all went through this stuff, but I really can't be bothered with it. I don't miss it at all.
Do you miss Rose as a housemate or a flatmate?
Yes, I do, actually. I really miss her as a flatmate. And really, I think, actually, thinking about the lockdown, it's probably a really special time to have that. And it's probably why, you know, we got so close. And yeah, it probably was overall a good thing. But I wouldn't want to do it again.
and without like prying too much, how long had you and Al been together when lockdown happened?
A long time, actually. So that's quite good 5 years or something like that.
So it wasn't like those stories you heard of some people going in like in a recent thing and things accelerating quite rapidly and then maybe deteriorating quite rapidly.
Exactly. No, we'd already accelerated. Our acceleration was done. So that was good. And we probably decelerated for a minute or something. And then you know, got back on track. Oh, but yeah, it's fantastic. Thank God. That would have been really intense for Rose to... Because it's funny, because we first moved into that flat, you know, me and Al in one room, Rose in another. We did it because it was a nice flat, but also it was quite small. But, you know, we were always out doing different stuff to save money. Just completely made sense to save money. And now knowing that, oh no, this is going to be the place you're in for the longest amount of time.
Forever.
But yeah, that's all right. Anyway, I really did enjoy it. I'm just, yeah.
Can I ask, like, when so you're just about to start filming Starstruck, the first series of Starstruck.
Yeah.
And the pandemic hits. And then you're sequestered together for quite a long period of time. When did filming start on the first series of Starstruck?
Well, it felt like so far in the future at the time, but looking back, it was really impressive. I think it was October 2020. So we were one of the first COVID productions.
Right.
So we were masked, you know, the whole time.
Yep.
Weird experience. Never really got to know the other cast very well in that first series because...
Right.
Like we did and we didn't, but you know, you remember what it was like of just not really being able to like connect. So it meant doing the second two series afterwards was such a joy because you just felt so the relief of having a more normal production. But
When you came back on set together, had you been living again together again, or was that the first time you'd been together again on set?
Yeah, the first two series, we were living together for both those series. So really easy for the pickups. And then then the third series, we'd moved out. And that's actually a really nice thing. But the third series actually does the same thing. We've moved out in the third series as well. There's a lot of life art stuff in that show, which is really nice.
And is that, I know you said you don't ask too much about the questions about what Rose writes. Is it a surprise? Like you go, oh, hang on, this is just literally, did she ever say, is it okay if I use this or is that, or is it just you read the script and go, oh, right, okay.
No, she'd never ask if it's okay, which I love, you know, because that's, it shouldn't be like that. But she will text me. She'll text me more like, you're getting married to Al. And that's about a script, even though that's also perhaps what's happening in real life.
Oh, you went method.
I felt forced to marry Al in real life. Yeah. Rose is very difficult to work with. And she said, you have to marry Al. And I did it. I did it for the show.
Now, lockdown may or may not have been an influence on Starstruck. But what about your film, Sex and the City? What are the influences on Sex and the City from film or TV or literature or comics or theatre? Are there influences that you love that you want to incorporate into this film?
Yeah, I mean, I love the movie Hustlers. I think it's so fun. It's just, I love the cinematography of it. I think it's great. I also love Bridesmaids.
Yes.
And I love the Lego movie. So I know that's very disparate stuff, but all of them have such a sense of fun, are like actually funny, have a great kind of pace to them, are very imaginative. I'd like to bring that to this movie. I'd like it to feel like a romp.
A romp.
I want the biopic of my life to be a romp.
That's such a nice vibe. That's such a nice vibe.
It's fun to be in a romp. Yeah.
Because biopics are often quite serious.
Surely I think romp is the most common desire of anyone.
To romp.
Oh. I just want a romp of my life.
Isn't that what life should be though, Emma City? Shouldn't life just be a romp?
Totally. Well, no, a romp does have hardship, to be very clear. A romp has to have hardship, but it's dealt with in a kind of topsy-turvy way.
Right.
And this, of course, is not life itself, is, you know, can get very hard, but I want the movie to have the romp feel.
There's always that thing in films, isn't there, with the switch. Is there a phrase for that in writing where all of a sudden they go into the bit where, oh, this is the hard montage where they're basically life's and they go into the trough and then they have to come up the other side.
I think that's often called bad guys close in. But it can also be called Dark Night of the Soul. But that's usually the real turning point where they understand how to change it. But right. Bad Guys Close In is the nice, right, okay, here's some freaking problems. a romp's only worth its salt if it has that. You need to have the lowest of the low. You need to have the salt with the sugar, you know?
What would be in Sex and the City? What do you think would be the lowest of the low? What would be the moment, the Bad Guys Close In turning point?
I don't know, you know. I think, well, I put it on the cutting room floor, but I think lockdown, yeah, maybe lockdown was it. I think, you know, I really enjoy London. I enjoy gigs, doing gigs. Like, I enjoy my job, really love what I do. So I think lockdown was a bit of a... And I think Starstruck was so exciting to get to do that and to do that with your friends. And also a moment when you're forced to be with the people you love like too much. I think that was a bit of the Bad Guys Close In. But still, I mean, that's not exactly that dark, is it? But that's in keeping with the romp, I think. You just want something that's a little bit... Oh, God.
I don't know. I think being locked, literally almost locked in your house 24 hours a day with the people who you love the most and with no end in sight to what is clearly a global issue is actually pretty dark.
Maybe that's a good Dark Night of the Soul. Yeah, yeah. And then if we wanted to push it way back, as in if we wanted to put the whole time period of the movie earlier on, Bad Guys Close In would be my second year, I didn't get in to the comedy show that was going to Edinburgh.
Damn it.
Not that big a deal. But for me, my reaction to that was terrible. I was devastated for months, but maybe even years.
Really?
So I think, you know, a movie only makes sense to you, like, provide the logic of the movie, right? So I think you could maybe sell that moment. And that, to me, that moment was so devastating because a fellow student said to me that I hadn't found my comic voice yet. And, you know, when someone's like, when you're 19 and they're 20, you're a bit like, fuck you, mate.
Yeah.
But fair enough. And, you know, because then it's happy ending to the movie because I go on to do comedy, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
But in that moment, I really remember that. It's sort of like, when have you been most devastated in your career?
Yeah.
For me, it was actually a non-career, like pre-career student moment.
Wow. And which group was that? Which university group was going to?
Oh, God. It was Footlights. Yeah, it was Cambridge.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Impressive.
All men that year. All
was
men.
It?
Yeah. I just I went to the library bathroom and sobbed. Obviously, that's over the top, but it's also good to care that much about stuff, as long as you don't go on about it to too many people. But if you yourself are devastated and grieving, and it can encourage you to try and do something else, that's quite a good thing, I think.
But were you better than the person or other people in the group? Were you better?
I was so much better. No, you can't. Yeah, of course I wasn't better, but this was my goal, you know. This had been my real goal since the moment I got into the uni, I guess. The moment I got into Cambridge, I sort of wanted to do that. So in that sense, I just felt, I think it was also because it was all men going up. I was like, that feels wrong.
That's pure frustration because then I'm, you know, frustration that you've not been recognized, you've not been included, but then also there must have been a feeling, and I'm guessing here, that when is that door going to open? If it's all men this year, it's going to be all men next year. And when so am I ever going to get a chance? Is anyone else ever going to get a chance? Are they just going to have this tight group?
That's what it felt like at the time. But also what I didn't realize at the time is that university is a total conveyor belt of humans. So actually what happened is that I had to skip a year because my year abroad, but then when I came back it was majority female, so that just goes to you know, it wasn't actually as intense as it felt like in the moment. And I think things do get aimed at the Footlights now and again for being like sexist or racist or whatever, but actually it just depends on your year group. And I was in a very male year group, and then the year after that it was, you know, diverse in every way. So yeah, that's good.
Who are you in? Who
no, I can't name that. No.
In your year group, you can't say who you were in with in the
Oh,
group.
I can say my girls group. Yeah. Matilda Winnick, who is a TV screenwriter now, really brilliant screenwriter. Rosa Robson, who's an amazing comic actor, and Matty Bradley, who is a comic writer. So I had a great year, but the final Matty is a man, and the first three of us, we're women. So that was a wicked show. It was a real joy to get to do that as a student.
And you guys still in touch?
Yeah, yeah. I went to one of their Hindus last weekend.
Was it as messy as a Hindu in Starstruck, or which might be seen in series three? Or
It was quite messy actually. No, it wasn't that messy. It was just it was raucous.
Ah,
yeah.
Was it a romp?
It was a romp. A huge romp with no obstacles.
Now, if the critics love or hate Sex and the City, the movie, how would that affect you in your next project? Do critics affect you in the next project?
I don't think so too much. With Edinburgh, I've never read reviews of my stuff. And I think you should just go on how the audience seem to be reacting. If they're coming, if they're laughing. And if they're not attending and they're not making any noise, then you have a shit show and you need to sort it out. But otherwise, I do think with comedy, unlike a lot of arts, you can go off something very clear, which is, are people laughing? And I've definitely done stuff before. I almost don't want to say what it is, but there's something I made that, like a short film, that I just don't think is very good. And then we had this screening and there was really no laughter. And that sucks in the moment, but it does mean you can't really argue with that. You have to just make sure your next thing makes people laugh. So that's what's quite useful if this was a comedy.
Mm.
If I was in the screening and everyone's going crazy and loving it, I'm like, brilliant, this was great. If no one's laughing, well, shit then. You've got to do something else. But and so it means that I genuinely don't worry too much about critics or reviews. With comedy, I think it's trusting your sense of humour. And I knew that with my sense of humour, this thing that I wrote and made and was in, it wasn't actually making me laugh enough. So, you know, you're in a different situation if you're cracking up about this stuff and no one else is laughing at it. Then you're like, oh, God. But, you know, I made this thing where I was like, I don't know about this. And, you know, and I know what makes me laugh and I've made something that doesn't make me laugh that much. So the watching it, I kind of made sense to me. Whereas to be honest, something like, you know, we talked about Princesses Awakening, but I don't know if you should say this about your own work, but I do find that funny. And so when people say they loved it, it's so lovely. And it's like, okay, great. Because then we share the same sense of humor. We're sharing something there. It's not just the abyss, you know?
Well, I think you're allowed to say you really find something of yours funny. And I think, you know, I think you Thank should you. Say that, because otherwise, what's the point? What's the point?
And then it's funny because I was in Alan Partridge Live, as you said, actually, last year, this arena tour, and that got really mixed reviews. And I didn't actually really read them, but I saw the stars, basically. There was a range of stars. And we had shows that were terrible. I hope Steve doesn't mind me saying that. And we had shows that were brilliant. So again, you can look at the, you don't need to take them too personally, I don't think. Like one of the 4-star reviews, I remember being like, oh, that was a brilliant night. Yeah, loved it. That was just fantastic. And then you see the 2-star and you go, oh yeah, it did kind of suck that night. But that's how comedy works, you know. That's just one of those things. Obviously, some things are just 5 stars across the board, but you know, a lot of stuff you just gotta be realistic about it.
I mean, I'm intrigued as to how something as sort of tooled as that show was, having watched the edited version that went out on Prime Video. Why were some that's better than others? Was it the audience? Was it the energy in the room? Or was it what was there anything?
It's such a bizarre thing. Because I'd never played arenas before. Obviously, never will again. The rarest thing for a comedian to get to do, a comic like me, like more of a comic actor, because stand-up comedians who've done it. Who is it? Somebody said to me, I've forgotten who it was now. Anyway, a stand-up who's done support for people, really big people like Frank Skinner or whoever. He said, oh, get ready for Leeds and Dublin because they are just the most amazing arenas. And, you know, I think it's an amazing arena, is it? Right. So, it's, you know, 6,000 people, the same as the majority of the arenas. He's like, no, really, Leeds and Dublin are just going to blow you away. And he's absolutely right, because these things are so huge that the architecture affects the laugh and the feeling of intimacy and togetherness. So something like the O2 is crap, like really, really miserable to perform in that, because it's just so, it's so long and empty feeling. You just feel like no one's turned up, even if it's sellout. Whereas Dublin and Leeds, they're like, sorry, this is not interesting. But anyway, I'll just.
It is, Emma, because I think, because I don't think people realize what it's like for people on stage in these venues.
Right. Yeah. It's a weird thing. The Leeds and Dublin, they have a very similar architecture, which is clam shaped. So even though there's 6,000 people there, they feel like they're on top of you. Like they feel right in your face, like you're all in this little theater together, despite the fact it's an arena. So those shows, just like, oh, Sean McLaughlin, that was who said it was going to be great. And just like Sean McLaughlin said, those shows were unbelievable. But it's the same material that's in the O2, that's the filmed Amazon one, that felt like cavernous. Like me and Steve were a bit like, oof, gosh.
It's a problem. I saw Monty Python there.
At the O2?
Yeah. You know, wow. When they did that stage show, they came back.
Yeah.
I would never go again. Literally to anything there. Because of the distance, the energy.
Yeah.
I mean, actually, to be fair, I saw the Chemical Brothers there, and that's amazing. But it's
Chemical Brothers. Yeah, it's like fine. No, it's specifically
on
about
stage
comedy.
It's just, yeah. It's for me just an absolute, it dies. I find it's just disconnecting. It's
my top tip would be go and see it at Leeds. Go and see Monty Python at Leeds. Whatever arena thing that's comedy that is coming to O2, or even actually like Birmingham, those long arenas, find the Leeds dates, book a hotel and have a great night in Leeds, because it is so different.
After Stratagem, did you look forward to playing small places again, like small intimate spaces again? Did you do it going on to?
Yeah, but it's so much scarier, it turns out, doing small places, because you can see people's faces. Whereas when it's this arena and the laugh feels like a carpet of laughter. It's just amazing.
I just don't think you know what you want. I just don't think you know what you want, Emma. You want the big sounds of the laughter, but you don't want to see their faces.
It's true.
Well, congratulations. Sex and the City, the movie, is in the can. And it's the premiere night. Where's the premiere taking place and who's invited? Is the premiere taking place at Leeds or Dublin by any chance, the arena for the massive audience, so the laughter reverberates around as they watch?
Go on. Yeah, let's just do it at Leeds. I think that'd be brilliant. I love Leeds. I think it's so much fun. I honestly love it. I was going to have my hen do in Leeds, but there was a train strike. That's how much I love it. So yeah, let's do it in Leeds. We'll do it at the Leeds Arena to make sure everyone can make it, because 6,000 people are going to want to come. Yeah, I think we're great.
With that amount of space, who is invited? Who's invited? 6,000 of your closest friends.
I'll invite the Labour Party, because they need all the help they can get. You know, it's time to get moving. It's time to build a profile. Let's see you there. I'd love to invite Sue Gray as well. I'd love to meet her, just get to know her a bit better. And I think it's quite rare to have a whole political party invited to something, especially something that's not political. So I think that would cause a bit of a storm. And then maybe the Greens and the Lib Dems as well. They can come if they really want.
Right.
And that's it.
It's increasingly sounding like you're inviting Parliament and the parties that represent, bar one party or one who is represented in Parliament.
To be fair, I haven't invited the SNP, have I? But I'm not Scottish, and the film won't have any Scottish scenes. There'll be a bit in it. The SNP can come if they want as well. whoever can come.
And who isn't invited to the premiere and why?
I wouldn't invite my parents, because they'll be mad, and they'll make too much of a thing of it that it's a biopic about my life. They're very proud, which is so wonderful, but
that's
they would
nice.
Dominate. But to be fair, if it's in the Leeds Arena, that's quite a big space. So yeah, I'll let my parents come. Maybe I wouldn't let Liz Truss, because she'd be desperate to come, and I'd just have to say, Liz, You can't.
Well, she shouldn't. I mean, definitely shouldn't be put in charge of the budget for the premiere, because before you know it.
Oh, it'd be a nightmare.
Well, congratulations. There we have it. Sex and the City, the movie, starring Emma Mackey as Emma City, featuring a nine-year-old sending in sketches to the BBC, Reeves and Mortimer, Victoria Pyle, a parents' evening, terrifying children by pretending to be a Spanish troll, going method and marrying your co-star just to help out with the making of Starstruck, the Mexican woking, and a human conveyor belt. Emma City, congratulations on being greenlit.
Thanks so much, Toby. That sounds pretty fun, actually. That sounds better than I thought. Love that. I think it'll be a real laugh, a real romp.